First case on calendar today is 73743, Court of Appeals, McCrory versus State Department of Corrections. Counsel, if you wish to reserve any time, please so state. And remember, that comes out of your 15 minutes.
So, good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lisa Rasmussen. I am pro bono counsel to the legal aid office for Mr. McCreary, the appellant in this case. I would wish to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. So this, and also, I should also say, with me at counsel table is my associate, Jim Hoffman, who has also worked with me on this case.
Good afternoon.
This case stems from a civil rights case that was filed under Section 1983 in White Pine County in the 7th Judicial District Court. My client is an inmate at Ely State Prison, or was at the time, and he filed a 1983 claim rather inartfully, setting forth some legitimate claims of causes of action and some that are, you know, questionable as to whether they are legitimate. He ultimately, or initially, he alleges at the heart of it that he was sexually propositioned by another inmate, and then he was placed in a cell after complaining about being propositioned by that inmate, was placed in a cell with that inmate, and that the guard in that particular unit didn't do anything about it. He filed several grievances on that particular issue, and in each of those grievances, he cited, it's actually hard to read some of them. I can't read all of them. These come in carbon form, and they're multiple layer copies. So when we got them, we couldn't read all of them. But what the ones I can read, you can see the dates on them if you can't read the text of it. But the ones I can read, basically, he cites to this issue with being placed in the cell, and he states that it's a violation of PREA. PREA being, of course, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. He ultimately files his complaint and states that his PREA rights were violated under the Eighth Amendment, the First Amendment, and the Fourth Amendment. His Fourth Amendment claim is convoluted and doesn't make a lot of sense, and I'll concede that. His First Amendment claim, and I'll get to the Eighth Amendment last because I think that's the most substantial. His First Amendment claim appears to be that he attempted to send documentation of these violations of the Prison Rape Elimination Act to the auditor or to the people who gather evidence of Prison Rape Elimination Act issues, and that the prison did not mail them out. And I think that's actually sort of artfully claimed as a First Amendment claim because it's a failure to allow him to speak and to provide information.
I guess as you frame that issue, the question within the question is, how does that relate to the case presently before us light of the fact that he has some other actions in the system?
I understand. And I think the answer to your question is he's a pro se inmate who doesn't understand the law and is very inarticulate in the pleading and doesn't really explain it in the context that I would had I drafted it, but he's not a lawyer. And I think the district court had a requirement to review what was filed and to analyze it in the manner most liberal to the complainant, to the plaintiff. On his Eighth Amendment claim, however, you know, he states it's a violation of PREA, but what it really is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. He's placed at risk in a dangerous situation in a manner that he describes as deliberately indifferent, which would certainly arise to an Eighth Amendment claim under Section 1983. And unfortunately, when he files the complaint, he characterizes it as a violation of PREA instead of an Eighth Amendment claim, which is what it is. And then the state moves to dismiss, saying that he failed to exhaust his remedies because he checked the box on the form complaint that is provided by the law library. I have questions as to who drafted it, who provides it, why is this the form that's provided to the inmate? None of which I suspect will solve here today. But he checks the form saying that he didn't administratively exhaust, and this is on page 24 of the of our appendix, didn't administratively exhaust his grievances. And then he's asked why, and he says state or federal law regulation. So it's not clear what he was thinking, but I think at a minimum the district court had an obligation to determine what was going on and what he was thinking and why he said that, because it's clear from the cold record that he had in fact submitted multiple grievances on this original issue, which he characterized as properly, frankly, in the grievances as a PREA violation, and then no one did anything about it. So if you look, if we're looking at the question as to whether or not he has exhausted his administrative remedy, it's actually not clear, because there's this plethora of grievances, some of them you can't read in the record, and the state has never said in any of its pleadings, he did this, but he didn't do this, or he didn't file an appeal, or he didn't do that. All they have said is he concedes it because he checks the box.
Well, other than the box, do we have, you know, one of the advantages of having an administrative exhaustion requirement is you get a record below. There's some sort of findings by somebody. So the checking the box aside, do we have any findings from anybody? Do we have any record of any proceedings or anything else that happened below?
All we have, and it's often all we ever have on the grievances, is the response that's written from the staff, or it comes from the warden or someone higher up. And you can, you know, if you get a response you don't understand or think is wrong, you can resubmit another grievance, then you get a response. So those responses usually come on the grievance form, and we're at a disadvantage because we can't actually read them. We can read some of them, and we can read, like, dates. But the state has never said, and I don't know, you know, what other steps he was supposed to have taken beyond those grievances and the responses and then his response and then the response to that. Whether, you know, they're not arguing that didn't suffice for exhaustion. They're just saying he checked the box, and that's conclusive evidence on its face that he failed to exhaust remedies. I don't know what happens in the institution itself when the inmates go in and say, hey, can I have a template form for filing a 1983 claim? I don't know if it has instructions that come with it. I don't know who created it. For example, this also goes to the official, non-official, official individual capacity issue.
But counsel, coming back to the records before us, because this is supposition, it's outside the scope as you're talking and supposing at this point. So coming back into play as the 1983 issue, because that's your other issue of why this was dismissed down below, do you want to comment on that while you say that?
Right. So I think that the district court erred in dismissing it without making further inquiry. The district court should have held a hearing to make a determination as to what exactly was done administratively, because clearly from the cold record, something was done administratively. The state never argued the sufficiency of those administrative steps. They never said, for example, he did A, B, and C, but never followed through with D, therefore it's not exhausted. They simply are arguing that he didn't check the right box, or that he checked the box saying he failed to do it.
Under the 1983 civil rights claim, just looking at it statutorily, stating that improper naming of parties, improperly naming the state, how do you respond to that?
With regard to the district court's order that the state and the Nevada Department of Corrections were not properly named, or they were not properly sued under 1983, I don't disagree with the district court. The district court never got to the issue of the individual actors that were named. The state brings it up on appeal for the first time. It's not addressed in the district court order. And the state brings it up saying, by the way, he also said that they were sued in their official capacity, therefore they're immune. That's an issue that was raised on appeal for the first time, which is probably improper.
The state brought it up below, and the court in its order indicated that individuals could not be sued in their official capacity, but the court didn't state the legal conclusion, thereby dismissing them. And you argued in the brief that that meant it was dismissed without prejudice. But there's nowhere that a distinguishment was made between with and without prejudice. The final line in the court's order was, the district court's order was dismissed with prejudice, but it was a general statement. It didn't name the individual defendants.
And I don't think the district court did any analysis on it. The district court did specific purposeful analysis on MDOC and the state of Nevada, and I'm not disagreeing with that. But I don't think that it did any analysis, unless I'm not read the order recently or correctly. And on as to whether or not the individual actors could be sued. But to me, from the Seventh Circuit or the district court's order, it is clear that the reason the district court was dismissing it was twofold. One, failure to exhaust administrative remedy, and two, you can't sue the state of Nevada and the state under 1983 anyway. That's for individual actors, and you're suing them as if they're individual actors.
Right, but let's assume you're right. The court's order is not nearly as precise as it should have been. But isn't the law absolutely clear that individuals sued in their official capacities cannot be subject to a 1983 action, just like states and agencies cannot either?
Right, and I'm not disputing that, which is why I say I don't know why these forms are even given to inmates. Why would you? It's a 1983 form. So why are you giving people a selection of suing someone in their official capacity or their non-official capacity? I don't know if there's any. I mean, I don't know
again,
what it
counsel,
means.
We're supposing about those forms, what was given, what was not given, how he articulated what he articulated. You are down to 4 minutes if you wish to reserve that time for your rebuttal at this point.
I will. Thank you.
Again.
All right. Good afternoon, all. Chief Justice Douglas, Judge Gibbons, Judge Tao. May it please this court, this is Senior Deputy Attorney General Frank Hodger II for the State of Nevada, the Nevada Department of Corrections, and its employer respondents on this appeal from the 7th Judicial District out of White Pine County. I brought Deputy Attorney General Caitlin Brady. She helps out on the preparation of our appellate matters, and she is also a clerk to this honorable court. Additionally, I'd like to thank counsel for making this appearance and pro bono appearance. The appellate court appearances really are true pro bono cases, and these attorneys take a valuable time away from their practice to participate and advocate. While it arguably makes our job a little bit tougher, it also improves the jurisprudence in this area of law and leads to the development of important case law that we might not come to pass without counsel. So as I get to this matter, whether counsel frames the claims as a 1983 action or as a PREA violation, the claims are either procedurally barred or they are not cognizable. Now, before I go into my whole spiel, I would ask the court if there are any preliminary questions as to either the operations of Ely State Prison, the grievance process, or the PREA report audit coordinator process that may not be in the briefing.
Well, Ms. Rasmussen raised the question, and she said we probably wouldn't get that answer today. You're going to actually answer it for us?
If it provides context, I am happy to.
What the complaints forms are and who drafted them and why these are given to the inmates and why would there be a choice between suing an official or individual capacity, the forms for grievances and how you get that into the record, and then why wasn't there a hearing to determine exactly what did happen?
Most of it I can get to.
Well, I'm going to redirect you.
Okay.
That's outside the record at this point. I appreciate she raised it, but we are a court of record of what was offered below. If it wasn't offered below, we're not going to get into it up here.
Very good. And I'm certainly ready to go. Under a PLRA, exhaustion is an absolutely mandatory first step in any 1983 litigation. The doctrine of exhaustion prevents a litigant from seeking remedy in either a state or a federal court until all claims were pursued as fully as possible through the grievance process. This generally derives from administrative law, but frankly, the exhaustion is developed much more in 1983 due to the excessive amount of litigation. The most singularly difficult issue for Mr. McCurry to overcome is his failure to exhaust the administrative process. On the face of the complaint, he admitted to not exhausting prior to filing suit. He also attached grievances that attempted to agree with the process, but we're not fully done.
Well, so here's the thing. Exhaustion is an affirmative defense, and it's typically factual. Now, sometimes you can get to it on a motion to dismiss if it's clear from the face of the complaint itself that the claim is not exhausted, and you don't need any other facts outside the record, because by definition, a 12b-5 motion, you can't get outside the complaint, right? So I gather Ms. Rasmussen's argument is this. Yeah, he checked off the wrong box, but the facts as to whether there was exhaustion or not are more complex than just the checking of a box. So if that's, and I'm paraphrasing her argument, and maybe if I'm doing it wrong, Ms. Rasmussen, you know, correct me, but so the issue here is this. Presumptively, on 12b-5, we can never get out of the complaint. So how is it just the checking of the box that makes it clear in the body of the complaint itself, the four corners of the complaint, and nowhere else, that there was lack of exhaustion, or are there any other facts that we need to know?
I would argue that there are other facts that we do need to know on the face of the complaint. If NDOC was doing an exhaustion argument, generally they'll bring it under Rule 56, and they're going to attach everything. In this case, beyond just checking the box, as Exhibit C to his complaint, Mr. McCurry attached several informal grievances, first-level grievances, that purport to the issues brought up in his complaint. So Mr. McCurry himself brought forth the grievance process that he attempted to follow through, but then states that he didn't. Second important point is that in explaining why he did not exhaust the grievance process, he explains that he was bringing this suit under a federal law. That's, I guess, the second checkbox. There's an option of why did he not exhaust the grievance, and he checked the federal box option. Presumably, I don't presume, but because it appears that he's bringing FOIA claims, and therefore did not believe that full exhaustion was necessary. And even if that's the case, this is the sort of reasonable mistakes that Supreme Court case Ross and his progeny aim to eliminate. Even if he thought he was bringing a federal claim, he still needs to exhaust this. And that misapprehension as to the law did not excuse his failure to go through the process.
So you're saying it's not just checking the one box, it's checking that other box too, where he gives the reason why he checked the first box the way that he did. So that clarifies that, in fact, he intended to bring the case in the manner that he brought it.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say actually that's all three. It's composite. I think it's really important that he did attach the incomplete grievances. And I think it's important for two reasons. It showed the availability of the process, and it showed that...
To go to Judge Tao's question, why doesn't the Attorney General's office in responding clear it up by saying, yes, that is true, he did not exhaust his remedies because of X, Y, or Z, and attach that to your motion to dismiss instead of just making a general statement? Well, we can see that he didn't exhaust his remedies from looking at the whole record. I mean, there was only a very brief statement in the pleading filed below.
I'll try to step in my colleague's feet, and I believe there's a case of simply not getting to that point in the analysis. The district court's argument was simply on the face of not checking the box, thinking he was doing a federal FOIA claim, that we didn't need to get to that second step of the analysis. Again, that's kind of supposing. Because I know this can very much be a two to even three part analysis once you get to the...
Right. All you have to do is attach something and you say to the court, all right, this is a motion to dismiss, but if you think you're looking at things outside of the record, convert it to a Rule 56 summary judgment and we'll go from there. So you have a backup to it.
And I think, frankly, within the office, this office around that time had got some appellate turnovers from making 12b-5 and the alternative 56 motions as defective because they're making two pleading standards. So I think
this case is not unique. We've seen a number of cases. Some are resolved on motions dismissed and some are summary judgment.
Yeah. So I reckon he was just trying to be ultra careful in keeping it a pure B-5. But at that point, I can't really surmise much further.
So is there enough here on the record, though, for us to draw the conclusion that he didn't exhaust his administrative remedies and he didn't need to exhaust his administrative remedies? Because there are exceptions where you don't have to do it.
Yes, I'll get to the exceptions first, and then I'll circle back to whether it's sufficient. So the primary exception is whether the administrative process is unavailable. And in the Ross Supreme Court case, they kind of elucidated the three circumstances where the admin remedies are unavailable. That's if there's a dead end because the admin is either unable or unwilling to provide relief to the inmate, that the process is so opaque that no ordinary prisoner can navigate the system, and three, whether the actions of prison administrators thwart the efforts of the inmate. None of these three exceptions are presented in this court. The case law cited in the opening brief have very clear examples of when prison administrators effectively thwart an inmate. In the, I think, Abera case, a warden himself told the inmate not to file the grievance system. And that one's not here. McCreary is showing that the process is available by attaching his informal and first-level grievances to his complaint.
But remember, in a motion to dismiss, we're stuck within the four corners of the complaint. Once you go outside of that, we're probably looking at a summary judgment motion instead, which this was not.
Yes.
So in order to know from what he's attached, whether we know he did something, right? But in order to even know whether he exhausted his remedies, in other words, in order to know whether the documents he attached constitute exhaustion or not, don't we have to know what remedies are available? And once we ask that question, aren't we then outside the complaint already?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
Okay, we know he did some things. Yeah. He pursued some administrative remedies, okay? You're saying that he didn't pursue other ones. He didn't exhaust his remedies. There are more things he could have done. But once we ask that question, aren't we asking about facts that are outside the complaint? Don't we need to know factually what remedies are available through the administrative process? Because different agencies do different things. And workers' comp complaint, there's different levels of review. In a unemployment compensation benefits case, there's different levels of review because different agencies have different levels. Some have three levels, some have two, some have five. I don't even know how many the prison has, but once we ask that question, aren't we now outside the four corners of the complaint?
I believe in this case, I would submit that looking at the Seventh Judicial record, the Seventh JD record, that it never did look outside the complaint because it did stop at the face of the complaint where he admitted to not using the grievance system in its whole. And for that reason, the Seventh JD and Judge Fairman didn't get beyond that point to looking at as to whether he went into the alternative avenues, as to what he had available. And the state's argument in the district court that McCreary admitted to not exhausting the grievance process was not opposed in the district court, and that's what we're stuck with. And I think, you know, we all see this order and wish there was a couple more paragraphs fleshing out. Too bad, you know, there's not a transcript. But I think because that admission was not argued specifically, the court didn't get into the meat of it, of asking these other questions.
Let me flesh it out even more so. Based on what you're saying, would it be improper for this court to send it back for a further analysis, indicating that we would ask the court to fully explain its order? I know you don't want us to, but my question is, why shouldn't we?
Well, the first argument is, I'll keep going back to the admission as point one, but the other two issues in here also keep this as a claim that also keep this complaint defective. One that he especially can't get over.
So you want me to bail you out a little bit more from my own question?
Okay.
How much of it is a question of law?
No, I think, gosh, I think it all is, because there's not any questions. I don't, the way the court interpreted it, I don't reckon there's any questions.
Let's go back to one question of law then, and that is, if it's 1983 civil rights claim, the civil rights he's banking on is free of a cause of action he can assert.
No, and there's not a cognizable action.
They already agree. They're not even going to try and argue that one. So they agree that the PREA has nothing to do with this. It could only be the 1983 First, Fourth, and Eighth Amendment. And even now the appellant says that those are kind of shaky and they sort of focused on the Eighth Amendment part. But what about what I think is the bigger question? Can you even sue the state, the Nevada Department of Corrections, and the officers in their official capacity and survive a motion to dismiss?
I would say it depends on the type of requested relief. For instance, if they're asking for some kind of protective order or something like that, like an injunction for medical care, injunction to keep an inmate away, that sort of declaratory relief is appropriate for official capacity. But the first inquiry into a 1983 claim, before anything else, is whether an individual acting, whether as an officer of the state or just as himself, has denied another individual of their constitutional rights. And by failing to name Byrne, Sandoval, the defendants in their individual capacity, they don't get past that first inquiry. The official capacity is fine for declaratory relief, but when you look at what he requests, it's $25,000 to let the governor know. It's whatever the court deems appropriate, and it's to have a PREA report submitted into somebody else's case. So those aren't the sort of relief, I would say, that are contemplated by injunctive relief, declaratory action.
Does it make any difference that the judge did not specifically mention the individual defendants? He only made the general statement that the individual named defendants are sued in their official capacity. And then he goes on to say neither states nor their agencies can be addressed in a 1983 action. So it's the next sentence, but he didn't add the word individuals into that same sentence. Does that make any difference?
Go ahead and answer the question, then your time's up.
Okay. I was just reading that, and my best answer would be, is since I believe in the paragraph before he dismissed of each of the defendants and of the individual defendants, at that point he kind of crossed off the list, if you will, that since he had dismissed them under the exhaustion, dismissed the individuals under the exhaustion, now he had the two remaining defendants of the Nevada and the Nevada Department of Corrections.
Any other questions of counsel before he sits down?
No.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Okay, so I think there are, as the court has noted, exceptions under the PRLA. Whether or not the plaintiff, my client in this case, met those exceptions was not any kind of analysis that the district court undertook, so it's also outside of our record.
But isn't the answer, though, in the complaint? Because he not only checked the box, it said he did not exhaust his administrative remedies, he then checked and gave further explanation as to why he didn't do it, and he didn't give any of the stated reasons the federal courts have recognized as exceptions?
Well, with all due respect, I wouldn't have expected him to. I mean, this was already a really inarticulate complaint to begin with. I wouldn't have expected him to know what the federal case law said with regard to the exceptions.
Well, but
we are surprised from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, somebody would know that I'm subject to retaliation, so I couldn't dare go through that process. I mean, that's more of a common understanding. You think the guard is bad, and now he's going to go after you even more because you're suing him.
Well, I understand, but I don't know what was in his mind at the time, and I can't answer the question because I don't know why he checked either of the boxes, frankly. And again, I don't know what instructions are given. I just don't know. I will say this.
I talked to Mr. Tadre after court, and he apparently has the explanation.
I think I have a new mission actually after this. It's going to be revamping the forms. The state is right. There are circumstances, and arguably circumstances applicable to this case, where you can be sued in an official capacity for injunctive relief. One of the things he does ask for in the complaint is that he be provided, that the audit be filed into the record, that he be provided from the audit. That is part of one of the things he was
asking.
Does
it matter that that wasn't argued below or in the appellant's opening brief?
Yes. It's a mess all the way around. I want to say this, though. I think we would all agree, everyone here, that the PRLA, Prison Rights Litigation Act, is very burdensome. It imposes a lot of burdens and a lot of hurdles on inmates, and I understand the public policy of it makes absolutely perfect sense. It's to reduce litigation. Hopefully things can be resolved at a local level without the need to resort to litigation. It all makes perfect sense. It imposes burdens on litigants. And they're often steep burdens to climb, but it also imposes a burden on the state. And the burden it imposes on the state is that they are required, if they're asserting failure to comply with PRLA as an affirmative defense, they're required to prove that. And that goes to the heart of what the court is looking at and asking about, which is, you know, why wasn't that pled below? Why was the only thing that the state argued was you check the box, so therefore it's clear on its face, but it's not clear from the cold record because he submits grievances. And they never argued, yeah, he submitted level one, but he didn't do level two. They don't tell us what they are. They don't tell us how it was incomplete. That part was never proven, and that was why it was insufficient for the district court to dismiss under
12. Well, one of the other policy things, you're getting away from just the text of the rules, one of the policy advantages of having this administrative process is by the time the case gets up here, we have something of a record. Now, I'm going to jump way into the details of the case, but just as an example, his claim is this guy tried to rape me and the prison retaliated against me for reporting by throwing me in a separate cell. If this had gone in front of a full administrative tribunal, I imagine, and I'm not going to speak with the prison, but if I had to guess, I would guess their defense is, no, we threw you in there for your own protection so you wouldn't actually get raped. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but if there had been exhaustion, or if there had been a hearing, if the prison had been able to actually have an adjudicated process, we might have a document in which the prison says, this is our policy, this is what happened, and then we wouldn't be sitting up here wondering, and having him volunteer all these facts on the record. We have the record, and that's, you know, as a policy, that's what we're missing. The argument is that's what we're missing here when he may not have exhausted the administrative remedies. I know you're out of time here, but maybe you could let me know what your response to that is.
I absolutely agree with you, and I also think what we're missing is what the administrative remedies were, what were the steps he was supposed to have taken, and how does that compare to the steps he actually took. That's what's missing from the record, because they didn't brief that.
You're out of time, but we chewed up your time a little bit, so give us your closing thought about why we should overturn
My closing thought is that it should be remanded to the district court to have an analysis made on the exhaustion issue at a minimum, and also with regard to the official capacity issue, because the district court doesn't address it. And I think it was important, I think it's important that they address that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The court thanks counsel on both sides for presenting the argument this day. We are in recess till our next case at 2:30. But before we adjourn at this point, we do have students here. Thank you for being here, listening to arguments. I'd like to have counsel